You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you conversations with practitioners, authors, and scholars who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please reach out to us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. If you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you listen on. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
So today I'm joined by Elizabeth Atwood, who's written a fascinating new book entitled The Liberation of Marguerite Harrison, America's First Female Foreign Intelligence Agent. I guess the most obvious question, Elizabeth, is how did you come across this? What led you to start researching the life of Marguerite Harrison?
Well, thank you, Andrew. I started to hear about Marguerite Harrison when I was a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. And, you know, she's sort of the folklore of the institution, as, you know, most organizations will have a history of people who used to work there. And so I had heard about her, and we actually had a photograph of her on one of our conference room doors. So there she was with her name, little biography, that this was a journalist who had been a spy and had been twice held by the Russians. And then some years ago, I moved from being a journalist to working at Hood College in Frederick, Maryland, where I teach journalism. And I had the opportunity to take a sabbatical. And I thought, I want to use this time to write the best story that I know that hasn't been written. And so I thought about Marguerite Harrison.
Help our listeners understand a little bit more about who she was and where she was coming from.
Well, her background is, I think, critical to understanding her and her work in espionage. She was born in 1878 into this prominent Baltimore family. And at the end of the 19th century, it was not uncommon for American women to marry British royalty or to make their way into European society. And her mother was very ambitious. And her mother had this idea that she was going to groom Marguerite to be the wife of a nobleman in Europe. And so she set about making sure she received the education to prepare her for that. They went to Europe every year. Marguerite became fluent in Italian, French, and German. She spent a semester at Radcliffe College before she ended up having an affair with her landlady's son, and her mother brought her home quite quickly from that. But her mother's ambition to get her to be ready to be the wife of a nobleman really was the groundwork that helped solidify her qualifications to be a spy. She defied her mother and ended up marrying a Baltimore banker. And so her life was very typical for a woman of her age and stature for a number of years. She had one child. She then was prominent in society. She would do all the things the society women would do. She would go to the card parties and the debutante balls. And she, of course, hosted all these events in her estate. She was living the life of a Baltimore socialite. And one of her most significant accomplishments at this time was she actually helped found a children's hospital in Baltimore that was really became one of the most significant and important children's hospitals in the country at that time and later on in the 20th century. So that was her typical life. But it all completely changed in 1915 when her husband suddenly died of a brain tumor. She could have gone back home to live with her father, who certainly would have welcomed her to come back home. But she made up her mind that she was going to support herself and stay in her townhouse in Baltimore City and raise her son there. And so she decided that she needed more money, and what she would do to earn the money, she would go to work at the Baltimore Sun as a newspaper reporter. And the editor appointed her to be the society editor of the paper. And so at first, all she did was cover society news. Then things start to change after World War I breaks out in Europe, and her assignments start to change. She goes from covering society news and reviewing movies and music and plays to actually writing propaganda pieces for the Baltimore Sun. And there we start to see some changes in what may have been her first forays into espionage. She does lots of stories about immigrant community in Baltimore. Of course, Baltimore at that time had a very large immigrant community, a large German population in Baltimore. And it was at that time, although she doesn't recall this in her memoirs, but there are documents that show it was at that time she started to give tips to the Justice Department about suspected German agents in Baltimore. And so we start to see a change in what she is doing and what her role is. And now we come to the World War I is nearly over in the summer of 1918, and she makes the decision that she will apply to be a foreign intelligence officer. And this was really rather astounding because she was almost 40 years old and had a 16-year-old son when she made this decision. And so she makes this plan that she's going to enter the Foreign Service. And she first applies to the Office of Naval Intelligence. But the Office of Naval Intelligence turned down her application and said that she was not qualified because it did not hire women. And so then she made up her mind to apply to the Military Intelligence Division, which was headed by Marlborough Churchill. And Marlborough Churchill, who was a distant cousin of Winston Churchill, was a friend of her father-in-law, Joseph Ames. And so with the family connection and her father-in-law wrote a letter on her behalf, Marlborough Churchill decided to take a chance and hire Marguerite Harrison to work for him in the Military Intelligence Division in September of 1918. And at that point, she became the first woman to go into the Foreign Intelligence Service. There had been one more woman who was hired by the Military Intelligence Service to be a spy in America. Her name was Anna Kleinman, and she went on to become a very prominent architect, but she was hired actually in the summer, in June of 1918, and she spied on suspected disloyal Americans in Philadelphia. But Marguerite was the first that was actually sent overseas.
Is there anybody else that is potentially a contender?
Sure, that's a great question because there have always been women spies, right? I mean, we look back at, Samson and Delilah, right? Women have always been spies. And in our country, we can look at some really prominent Revolutionary War spies. Anna Smith Strong, she was part of the Culpeper Ring that helped General George Washington. Lydia Barrington Darrah, she was a Quaker living in Philadelphia and the British stayed in her home. And so she was able to overhear their conversations and deliver coded messages in, I believe it was in the buttons of her son's jacket. Certainly they've had women working as spies in this country up in the Civil War. We can point to examples of Harriet Tubman, Belle Boyd for the South, Rebel Rose Greenhow, she was in Washington, D.C. So there have been always women that would work as spies to give intelligence, particularly in war times. The difference comes, though, with the development of a professional spy agency. And World War I came about. At first, we didn't really have much of a spy service of any sort, intelligence service of it, with any male or female. And the Army, Ralph Van Diemen particularly, was one of the forerunners of this. He had this idea that we needed to establish our own intelligence service within the Army. We could not just simply rely on getting our intelligence from our allies. And so that's where we see the creation of an American intelligence service with the Military Intelligence Division. You know, Tammy Proctor has done some great work on women spies in World War I, looking particularly at the British spies. American attitudes toward women spies was very different than that of the Europeans. You know, Tammy Proctor points out that there were something like 6,000 women that were serving in the British intelligence community in World War I. And yet in the United States, we see a very much of a reluctance to hire women. They thought that women would be maybe susceptible to falling in love with their targets. They thought that they could not be trusted to give military reports. And so there was this great reluctance to send women abroad as intelligence officers. What Marguerite Harrison was able to do in her job interview, which took place in Baltimore, she told the officer that she was well past what she called the foolish stage. So she was really well aware that the reputation that the American men believed that the women would be falling in love with their targets. So she acknowledged that straight up front, that she was well beyond that. She was not going to be falling in love with her targets. She insisted that she was qualified for this work because she knew Europe very well and she was fluent in three languages at that point. And she had a perfect cover story. She was a journalist, and her editor at the Baltimore Sun had agreed to this plan. So she had the whole thing planned out, and she was not going to be a spy like Mata Hari, you know, which is the most typical World War I spy we think of. You know, where you have a woman who is seducing her targets and exchanging sex for secrets. She was going to be a professional who was going to employ her languages, her knowledge of Europe, her experience as a journalist, and that was the way she was going to report on the events that, and what her role was to give intelligence to the Americans who were negotiating the peace treaty in Versailles. So that was her role, and she was well qualified to do it.
Give us a sense of some of those first forays.
Sure. There's a little bit of a disagreement. There is what she says she did, and there's what Ralph Van Diemen says she did. At that point, Ralph Van Diemen was over in Paris, helping to work counterintelligence for the peace accords. So she says that her role was to go into Germany and to report on the conditions on the ground, giving information to our negotiators about the sentiment within Germany and then other parts of actually Eastern Europe to help them be able to negotiate the peace treaty. And she mentions that when she arrived in Berlin, that would have been in January 1919, she recalls that there was the fighting in the streets of Berlin between the communist-backed Spartacist movement and the government troops that were still trying to hang on and stay in control. The reports that do survive get written like kind of like an economic reports on this is what the factories are producing, this is what the food supplies look like, these are the comments I've heard people make. So that's her account. Van Diemen, he gives a separate account that's a little bit different. And his account that he wrote many years later, based upon notes that he kept at the time, he says that her initial assignment was to keep a watch on the journalists who were sent to cover the peace accords. And that at some point, they got word that cartoonist Robert Minor, who was an American communist, was distributing propaganda in Germany, trying to encourage the American troops to become dissatisfied and to support socialism and communism. And he says that when they got that report, they then sent Marguerite Harrison to Germany to try to catch Robert Minor. And while she was there, she then came upon the whole Spartacist uprising and covered that as well. So there's a little bit of a difference of opinion.
And if you can tell everyone who Van Diemen was, and also who do you believe?
Well, Ralph Van Diemen is credited with being the father of the Military Intelligence Division. It was his foresight that helped persuade the Army officials to and the Secretary of Defense to actually establish the division. At that point, then he was seceded by Marlborough Churchill, then went over to Europe to get some more combat experience in Europe. So that was Ralph Van Diemen. So at the time that she encountered him, he was the head of the counterintelligence while stationed in Paris, working on the counterintelligence for the peace accords. I think that what the record that she reported on Robert Minor that is in the files at the National Archives more closely aligns with her recollection, you know, that she says that she did in fact go into Germany at some point.
What are some of the big currents of history that Marguerite finds herself caught up in? So,
of course, the World War One has just come to an end. The monarchy is starting to crumble. We have now a serious rise of communism. And the United States is trying to figure out what it's going to do in within this milieu of these social and political changes. When I read some of the accounts of this time period, it almost reminded me of the upheavals we see today. You know, I came across one newspaper article that said, this should ring bells to the American readers or listeners, that so there was a situation where they had to play the national anthem at this Victory Day parade, and one of the socialists refused to stand up, and so an American sailor shot him. And I, you know, you think, gosh, we're still arguing 100 years later over whether you should stand up for the national anthem. So that was the kind of world that was going on there. What does it mean to be an American? Who is an American? And it would be a few years later, and within 2 years later, we will start to see the rounding up of immigrants, the deportation of immigrants who were suspected of not being loyal to in the United States. And so that's the kind of world that she's operating in. She goes from now reporting on possible enemy agents who are German to possible enemy agents within the United States. And that's where her role starts to change in 1918 to 1920.
Give us a sense of what's happening to these reports that she's involved in. I mean, are they just one report amongst many, or are they particularly influential?
One of the most important accounts of our espionage at this time was written by a reporter, Thomas Johnson. He called it Our Secret War, and he recounted the American spy efforts in World War One. And he does not name Marguerite Harrison, but it's clear that he interviewed her when he wrote his book in 1929. He calls her Agent Q or Number 8. Her code name was Agent B, as in boy, or Baltimore, which I think it may have been the connection. But he calls her Agent Q or Number 8. And according to Johnson, her reports were so important, they went directly to Woodrow Wilson. I only found maybe 3 or 4 of these reports in her files. But she also had a real knack. This is why I think her journalism skills come in. She had a real knack for observing and talking with people. So in addition to these thick reports on, you know, statistics and data like that, she actually would talk to just about anybody she came across. You know, her maid, she would talk to. And some of these people, interesting that she socialized with while she was in Berlin, she actually knew socially while she was in America. They had been parts of, this top society. So for example, General Hans von Below, who had commanded troops against the Argonne in 1918, his wife was an American that Marguerite had known. She was from Philadelphia. So she struck up a friendship with this wife, and then she socialized with this couple while they were in Germany. And, you know, von Bello would tell her about, you know, his, you know, how they were hoping to bring back the monarchy. So it's very difficult to tell the how important her reports are. There's some estimates that when the war ended, the Military Intelligence Division had 282 officers, some like 29 sergeants, and 1,000 civilians. Of course, she would have been included in the civilian count. Johnson's report says that there would have been no more than 25 women, but he says almost all the women were volunteers that we had recruited in Europe to provide reports to us. Just putting the pieces together, she was, I think, an important agent. The other reason I would draw that conclusion is once that mission ended, the men who were in charge of the Military Intelligence Division were anxious to put her back to work. And this was at a time when the World War I ended, the division substantially downsized. There were very few people left in it, and most of them were code breakers. And so that tells me again that she was very well respected in what she had accomplished in Germany.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
And for the intelligence reports, is it more akin to the journals of Lewis and Clark, where you're immersed in a daily reality, or is it more like Democracy in America?
I think it's both. She has a lot of factual data that is just, you know, this is what it is, right? And yet she also brings in her own insights a lot. And that's why I think the men respected that. So she was not hesitant to give her opinion. She reflected on, you know, who she thought we could trust, who she thought was suspicious. And when she could, she would give her interpretations of the events and of the people she met. You see that come out a little bit more in the Russian reports, where she goes out a little bit more on the limb. Again, I'm only going with what I can find in the files. But in the Russian reports, I see her being much more subjective, you know, much more given her analysis of the people she had met and the conditions she had witnessed, as opposed to just concrete facts.
And do you think that's because she did not speak Russian, but she did speak German?
I think it's a combination. When she was in Germany, she was able to get the reports out in pretty much real time. And of course, she was fluent in German. In Russia, she did become fluent in Russian once, you know, she stayed there a while.
After she's finished in Germany, we know that she ends up in Russia. So talk us through how she ends up there. And I believe she ends up there a couple of times.
Our spy networks in Russia were in a shambles at this point. So we had this complete disaster of our intelligence service in Russia. And we had no coherent Russian policy. We didn't know which way we should approach the Bolsheviks. And we also had this rising situation of anarchy in the United States, where you'd had a series of bombings. And so there's this quite a huge concern about the effect of communism and Bolshevism, and what should our response be to the Bolshevik Revolution. So Churchill makes this decision to send Marguerite Harrison to Russia. It appears that her assignment was twofold. Her first was to ascertain the viability of Lenin's government. Was this a government that was going to last? And second, what has happened to the American prisoners? They had a couple dozen Americans were either being held in prison or being held in home detention, somehow captive, were not allowed to leave the country. And so that appeared to be what her mission was. She has one statement in her book that I think we need to keep in mind. She says that if I succeeded, no one would ever know. And she said, if I failed, I'd be repudiated by my government and perhaps lose my life. So we have to understand that not all of her successes were publicized, and even to this day do we know all of the successes. Nevertheless, it was clear that this was a risky mission to send her into Russia, given what had happened to the other agents that were in prison or had fled. And the idea that she later would pretend that nobody had an idea that this was a risky mission was just ludicrous. I mean, it doesn't uphold to the facts. And it's actually very typical of the way she kind of downplays a lot of her assignments and makes kind of this lighthearted banter about them. So in any case, Churchill decides to send her to Russia. And this is a big assignment and a very difficult assignment because she does not know the language. She only could pass as an American reporter who was going to Russia to try to write truthful and maybe even complimentary stories about the Bolshevik Revolution. And yet even this was risky because the Bolsheviks had already found out that there had been other spies that had done the same kind of ploy. They had done the same, pretended to be journalists and were in fact spies. But that was her only hope. And again, the Baltimore Sun supported this plan and gave her a cover and credentials that she was a journalist going into Russia. And all of this into the backdrop of the Russians already knew about this, and they were not giving credentials to Western reporters unless they came from socialist newspapers. They were very sensitive of what was going on. There was an embargo of the West had put in place against Russia. So the Russians did not want to allow the Western media or the Western press into Moscow or into Russia. So she develops this plan that she's just going to she's going to get across into Russia by going across the front in Poland, which of course Russia is at war with Poland at that time. So she makes her way into Poland, and she's told by Marlborough Churchill to stop, that they have received word that it would be too dangerous for her to proceed. And so she's told to wait in Poland until they give her clearance to go ahead. So she spends a number of weeks in the winter of 1919 in Poland and in Warsaw. And there, I'll give a little bit of a aside because it becomes important later. She is at a Red Cross dance where a nurse introduces her to this man wearing American man in a Polish aviator's uniform. And his name was Marion Cooper. And Marion Cooper, for those who may not recognize his name, I know you know his most famous movie, which is King Kong. And Marion Cooper was going to play a very important role in Marguerite's life later on. But at that time, they just had a very quick meeting. They danced together, exchanged pleasantries, and then he went on to his battalion. He was actually had raised an aviator battalion in Poland to help the Polish fight the Russians. So it was a couple weeks after that that Marguerite finally gets clearance from Marlborough Churchill that she could proceed into Russia. She has hired a translator, and they make their way by sled across no man's land into the eastern front of Russia near what's in now Belarus. I think the Russian army, the Reds, were so shocked to get this American journalist coming across the border with another woman translator. I think they were so shocked by these two women who have made their way into Russia, they don't know what to do. And Marguerite bet on that. She bet that they wouldn't kill her outright, although she had been warned that she'd be executed on the spot. But she bet that they wouldn't do it. And the gamble paid off. The army was so shocked, they were afraid to take any action against her. And so they just kept passing her from one place to the next until up the chain of command until they sent her on to Moscow. And there in Moscow, the Foreign Office says, hey, what are you doing here? You know that you don't have permission to enter this country, that we've not given permission for the Western newspapers to come into the country. But Marguerite, maybe following her governess's advice that it's better to be charming than smart, was able to charm them into letting her stay there. Now, the other thing that she didn't know when they allowed her to stay was that they already knew she was a spy. They had been able to intercept a document that she had filed while she was actually on the ship going over to Russia, that she filed a report against a man named Julius Hecker, who was a YMCA worker, and he was a communist sympathizer who was spreading propaganda in the United States. And while she was on the ship, she interviewed him, and she pretended that she was also socialist or communist, and that she was wanting to hear his tactics because she was wanted to do the same thing once she returned to the United States. So he told her everything he had done. So she filed that report when she got to Switzerland, and that report that she filed in Switzerland was intercepted by the Russians, and the Russians knew when she crossed the border that she was actually a spy. But she didn't know that at the time. So they allowed her to stay for a couple weeks, and to her surprise, they gave her permission to see reports that no Western journalist was allowed to see. And somewhere around Good Friday of 1920, this is early April 1920, she's on her way back from the Foreign Office to her hotel, to the guest house where she stayed, and she is arrested in the street. And she is taken to Lubyanka prison. And in Lubyanka prison, she there is introduced to a man named Solomon Mogilyevsky. He was a high official within the Cheka, the Extraordinary Commission. And his role was to oversee foreigners and particularly recruit foreign spies in Moscow. And Mogilyevsky says that he knows that she is a spy. And she first calls his bluff and says, I'm not a spy. How do you know I'm a spy? Because she had filed no reports at this point. But he pulls out of a briefcase the Hecker report that she had made against Julius Hecker while she was in Switzerland. And she realized that, you know, they had evidence against her. And he says, you know, I'll make a deal for you. Well, she first thought they would just expel her. But he says, no, we're not going to expel you. You know too much. And so then it becomes clear that why she had been given all this information from the unedited reports from the Foreign Office. And he says, I'll make a deal with you. He said, we'll let you go if you will report on foreigners in Moscow. And so she says, I accept. And so at that point, she becomes a double agent. And so from April until the end of October of 1920, she is trying to get reports out to the American officials, the American Army officials, and at the same time, given Mogilyevsky routine reports on the foreigners who are living in Moscow. And this is, of course, a delicate balance. That continued on until October, where she knew that it was only a matter of time where Mogilyevsky was going to get dissatisfied with her and realize that she was not giving him the kind of information that he wanted. But she was able to keep him off from, you know, arresting her until October. And then in October, they arrested her right on the eve of John Reed's funeral, in fact.
Am I right in thinking that she was also caught because there was a mole inside the State Department?
That's an interesting story, too. The report came from the State Department. The mole apparently was in the Military Intelligence Division, I believe is where it is. So she files the report in Switzerland, and then it's sent back to Churchill, and somehow, so it could have been somewhere within the in the consular's office consulate in Switzerland or in the military. And so they tried to locate the person, but they never were able to determine who gave that report on Hecker. But Hecker had a lot of friends. Hecker was a socialist. He had a lot of friends in Switzerland, where there was a big socialist colony.
So ultimately, she gets released, but then the following year, she ends up getting caught again. Is that right?
Okay, so she gets caught a couple times. So she is caught in April of 1920, forced to become a double agent throughout that spring and summer. One of the people that she betrays is a woman by the name of Stan Harding. And Stan Harding had been a woman that she had met in Germany, in Berlin. Stan Harding was a reporter for a British newspaper, but Marguerite Harrison also believed that Stan Harding was a British agent. So just as luck or not luck has it, that summer, while Marguerite is in Russia, forced into being a double agent, Stan Harding, who is a socialist, decides to come to Russia to write about the Bolshevik Revolution and Lenin's government. And she's working actually on behalf of an American newspaper at the time. And so she comes to Russia, and Mogilyovsky says, a friend of yours has shown up. I want you to give me information about her. And Marguerite at first doesn't know who he's speaking about, and then he tells her that he's speaking about Stan Harding. So Stan Harding does enter Russia and is brought to the guest house where Marguerite is staying. And within hours, actually, Selma Mogilyovsky arrests her and puts her in Lubyanka. And Stan Harding later starts to believe that Marguerite Harrison has denounced her and reported that she is a British spy. And that's why the Russians had arrested her. Stan Harding denied it the entire time. She said she never was an intelligence officer, that she was a journalist, and that she had been unfairly denounced. And she was held captive for 5 months in Lubyanka. She went on numerous hunger strikes. Her health was really jeopardized. Once she was released, she instituted a very hot public campaign against Marguerite Harrison and the American Intelligence Service, blaming them for having put an innocent journalist into Lubyanka. So, and back to your question about does Marguerite get arrested again? Yes, she is eventually released by the Russians for food aid, but it's been widely told that she was a spy. And she never publicly acknowledged it, but the rumors are all out there and they're published. And so you would think, well, that she would have no longer have a future within the intelligence service, given at least the Russians know that she's a spy. And yet, that spring, Marlborough Churchill sends her a note asking to meet her. And this is in April of 1922. Then we see Marlborough Churchill, he's no longer in charge of the military intelligence division. He's now in the general staff stationed in New York. But he sends out letters to the consulates, to the military attachés in Asia, saying that Marguerite Harrison would be planning a trip to Asia. That summer, she sets off for another trip, and she goes to Asia, and she ends up in the Far Eastern Republic. And in the Far Eastern Republic, she enters it just the day after its government collapses and is taken over by Soviet Russia. And there, becomes folded into Soviet Russia. She's on the streets of Chita when she's arrested again at gunpoint. And she is transported back to Moscow. This one is the most mysterious. The whole thing is mysterious. I say it's like reading a Jean Le Carré novel as to what she's up to. You could read it almost any way. You could say she's a communist. She's trying to make her way back to Russia. You could say she's an idiot. She's a fool for even going to the Far Eastern Republic, which was dangerous, and then she knew it would be. Or you could entertain the possibility that Marlborough Churchill had placed her on an assignment that was so sensitive that most American intelligence officials didn't know what she was up to. Her father-in-law, once he learns that she's arrested again, you know, sends out a flurry of letters to his friends that are in the State Department and in the Army, saying, what's up? What's going on with her? He ends up calling upon a distant cousin who was a major grain exporter, who apparently was able to persuade the Russians to let her go. I think that there's a possibility that, as I said, there are three different possibilities. She's a red agent, she's an idiot, or Marvel Churchill put her on an assignment that was very sensitive. I have no evidence of that. I have no facts of that. That's just me. But I think that it might explain what Churchill was up to and what he was trying to have her do.
And so if there's not any evidence for that explanation, is there evidence for the other explanations? I guess a couple of questions here. So we know for sure, I think I'm right in saying, we know for sure that she was a double agent for a period of time. So after she was released from Russia, after that period, did her American spy masters know that she was a double agent in Russia? And yes. If they did, why would they ever trust her again?
And yet there are reports within the files that I found, at least four reports that she made, given to the Army and the State Department on her observations that she saw when she was traveling through Asia. So she was still giving reports, officially or unofficially, to the State Department and the Army while she was traveling through Asia.
I guess I was wondering, although she was still submitting these reports, were these unsolicited reports that she was just, this is what I've done in the past, here's what I think about country X, or does that prove that she continued to be a spy, or does that just prove that she continued to think that her voice was being heard in Washington?
I think that's a great question. I think that it's possible she was giving unsolicited reports. Yet it's sort of mysterious that she's traveling with military attachés while she's throughout Asia. They are asking her, at least according to her account, they ask her to give her reports. There's no payroll document that says, you know, she was getting paid by the Army or the State Department. I don't know where the money is coming from. That's another mystery.
I want to circle back just for a second to Stan Harding. I find that relationship really fascinating.
So let's talk about that a second. So Marguerite Harrison, in her biography, autobiography, she writes about two instances where you might imagine that she has, that she might have an attraction to women. I ask her granddaughter about it, and looking at all the other evidence that's there, and I've concluded that I don't think that Marguerite was a lesbian or bisexual. And the other, but the question, did she throw her under the bus? The answer is yes, she did. That is in the Russian files that I saw, her Russian prison files. She did say that Stan Harding was a British agent. And Maglievsky writes in the report that she gave no worthwhile information. That's why he arrested her in October. He said she gave no information that was any worth except a report on Stan Harding. She denied it. She denied it forcefully when she came out of prison that she had betrayed Stan Harding. But the prison files show she did, in fact, identify Stan Harding as a British agent. And she later says in the second file, the second imprisonment, that she did so because not that she had concrete evidence, but that she believed so based upon the things Stan Harding told her, that she surmised that Stan Harding was a British agent.
Just to be clear, that was from a book, The Lady is a Spy by Melanie King.
That's the challenge with her. Marguerite Harrison is not a hero, and she's not always a sympathetic character. She could be ruthless. She was egotistical, and she was not always truthful. She tended to omit more than lie. The Stan Harding one was, I guess, the exception. So how do you reconcile it? That's the job of the historian. You know, you try to draw on all the sources you can. So you look at, you know, the files that are in the National Archives, and in there you'll find her reports, her letters, the reports that other people have said about her, then, you know, you're looking at the other biographies that are the other accounts that have been written about her. I interviewed her granddaughter, which was very interesting because although her granddaughter, of course, knew nothing about all the details of the spying, she had real insights into what the woman was like as an elderly woman. And it was amazing how many of the character traits survived until the woman was in her 80s. I mean, you know, the strong-willed, arrogant teenager survived as an old woman. Her granddaughter told me the story of her flirting with the husband of her, it would have been the in-laws. So not her, you know, she was still a flirtatious debutante in her 80s. A lot of it she's into for herself. And Stan Harding is an example of that. She betrayed Stan Harding to save herself to a large extent. But yet she was loyal to some, in some cases she was extremely loyal. She never gave up one of the British agents who was there, which is Francis McCullough. They pressed her hard to get her to say that he was a British agent, and she never did. She was faithful to Marion Cooper. She never betrayed Marion Cooper. There was other evidence where if she liked someone, she would never betray them, no matter the risk to her own life. She tended to betray the socialist and other people that she didn't like, I think.
Okay, so that's why she betrayed Harding, because of Harding's political beliefs?
I think so. I think that gave her that appeased her conscience enough. Yeah, I this is, you know, of course, wrestling with what's the takeaway here? And I point out that she, in many ways, you would call her a failure, right? She betrayed a lot of her family members, you know, by certainly her son, that she kept leaving him. She abandoned him basically at a Swiss boarding school while she went to Russia. She certainly betrayed Stan Harding. There were other journalists that she betrayed as well. William Estes, apparently, she gave testimony to, who was another. He actually was another journalist spy, but she told the Russians that he was a spy. So that's a head scratcher as well. So yes, she's complicated. You think, well, she was not a very good agent, right? She got caught over and over again. Like twice at least, the Russians caught her. And yet I keep coming back to the statement that she said, you know, if my success is, you know, well, you'll never know my successes, only my failures. And I think that there was some real success there. And I think the most important success we should take away from her is the precedent she sets as a person who, as a woman who was hired because of her intellect, her linguistic skills, her familiarity with the culture. And obviously, first of all, she succeeded well enough that they trusted her with important missions in Russia. They reached out to her again in some way, although we don't fully understand how, in Asia and later in the Middle East, when she worked with Marion Cooper and Ernest Schoetzeng to film the movie Grass, which was a cover for a spy mission. And obviously she did well enough that by the time World War II breaks out, thousands of women are hired by the OSS to work in jobs of as code breakers, but also intelligence officers and analysts and spies. And so I think that they were pleased enough with her work to know that she had made a real contribution. And that's where I think we have to take it away. Personally, she's not always a very likable person, but I think that's true with a lot of spies. You know, a lot of spies are very egotistical, you know, especially double agents, you know, the idea that they'll never be caught, they're too smart, you know, they like playing the game, the thrill of it. I think there was a lot of that with her. I think she loved the thrill of the game. And, you know, what were the prospects for a woman in 1919? She did not see herself as a school teacher. She wasn't going to work in a shop. She had tried that once briefly and hated it. She had the ego and the intelligence to believe that she could work in the intelligence service. She writes to Marvell Churchill straight up and says, if you can't use me as a foreign intelligence agent, I don't have any interest in doing anything else because that's where I'm qualified. And it's the only thing that would lure me away from the job that I'm doing now, which was, of course, writing propaganda pieces for the Baltimore Sun. So she straight up tells him, if you're thinking about me as a secretary, forget it. You know, I'm going to be an intelligence agent or nothing. So she had an ego. And I think that that was good, though. I mean, you know, she was not always a nice person. Would I want to be friends with her? Probably not. But I appreciate the contribution she's made so that other women could follow in her footsteps. And years later, you know, we can see the women working for the OSS, the CIA. And now, of course, we have a woman who's heading up the CIA. And it started somewhere, and it started with Marguerite Harrison.
I think that's a good place to bring our conversation to a close. I had a couple of quick follow-up questions, though, which may or may not make the cut. Number one is, as a fellow reporter, was she any good at it?
She's a great writer. I love her accounts of, she had this really vivid account of where she goes off to cover an aviation camp in New York, and she gets into this airplane with this pilot, and you know, she tells of them taking off, and all of a sudden the propeller stops and goes dead, and her reaction was, oh, I'm in for a real thrill now. And the pilot manages to coast the plane to a landing. She gets out, the mechanic comes out, repairs the plane on the spot. She climbs back in, they take off again. They make this great landing at the hangar. And she says, the only thing is, I just had oil splashed on my stockings. And, you know, she's just such a great storyteller. Yeah, you have to, she's a wonderful writer, wonderful storyteller. She's a very shrewd analyst. Her reports that she gave, the articles she wrote about Germany, they really are like, she saw these street battles in Berlin that really make you kind of call to mind Edward R. Murrow in London years later with the World War II, the Blitzkrieg. Today's journalists would frown upon what she did. You know, that is a bit extremely dangerous to have a journalist working in foreign intelligence. And of course, the practice didn't end with World War I. It's continued up until modern times. And the CIA has finally been called to task to stop it because it is extremely dangerous. There's some thought that, in fact, Marguerite Harrison's well-publicized, you know, stories and denouncing of Stan Harding actually helped lead to the first newspaper code of ethics. So as a journalist, I hated that she was working for intelligence services because it's very dangerous for any journalist to be doing that. It's dangerous for anyone who comes after them. But as a storyteller, I appreciated her writing. She's a great storyteller.
I guess the second follow-up question was, is it true that she enjoyed tea with Queen Victoria and interviewed Leon Trotsky and Mustafa Ataturk?
So those connections are, you know, just her being part of society, right? So as part of high society, she, well, first of all, her father was a shipbuilder in Baltimore. And he donated a ship to England as they fought the Boer War. And as part of the gratitude that they felt for his ship donation, they invited him to the whole family to have tea with Queen Victoria and Queen Victorian's garden party and the Ascot race. She was in the royal box at the Ascot races and so on. So it was in gratitude for his donations of the ship during the Boer, a hospital ship during the Boer War. To Ataturk, if she's in the Middle East, she is, you know, reaching out, making these connections as a, pretending to be a filmmaker and a journalist. So she interviews Ataturk. Trotsky, she says that she sees him in a courtyard in at the Kremlin as she's leaving an exhibition there, and she rushes up to him and introduces herself as this American journalist, and he, they speak a few words in French, and he kisses her hand and wishes her a pleasant stay. So yeah, those are, she's in some ways like the Forrest Gump of American espionage. She always seems to run into these famous people all around the world. You know, the Society of Women Geographers that she helped found later would include members like Margaret Mead and Amelia Earhart.
And I believe that Edith Wharton, the novelist, she was involved in the history of American intelligence and in some way.
Yes, so the story goes that Ralph Van Diemen, in trying to get the, I believe it was Baker was the Secretary of Defense at that time, he was dubious of whether we needed to have an intelligence service. He thought, you know, why do we need an intelligence service? We can rely on our allies to get the intelligence we need. And Van Diemen was really thought it was very important that we have our own intelligence service. And so he had Edith Wharton gave her a tour. And so while he had her ear, he says, you know, we really need an intelligence service here. And I think Edith Wharton then took that message, I guess, was it to Wilson? I've forgotten the details, but Edith Wharton then passed that word up to the American officials. You really need your own intelligence service. And so Van Diemen was able to use a woman to get him what he wanted in that case.
And final question, completely unrelated to the life of Marguerite Harrison, but as someone that worked for the Baltimore Sun, what do you think of The Wire, especially season 5, where he looks at the Baltimore Sun, looks at the Baltimore Sun?
That's funny. I always said that was David Simon getting back at the Baltimore Sun. David Simon, he had his love-hate relationship with the Baltimore Sun. And so there's a lot of inside jokes about that series, those episodes with the newspaper. He's making digs at the people he didn't like, and he is including friendly comments about those he did. So it's a lot of inside jokes with that show. It's a great show. So my little claim to fame that I briefly worked with David Simon at the Baltimore Sun.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 non-profit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and would like to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.